A 98-year-old man arrives at the clinic. His nickname? Kid. The neurologist has prescribed him daily aspirin for stroke prevention, a medication that, at his age, poses more danger than benefit. Internal bleeding, hospitalization, even death. These are the risks we're willing to impose on someone who has outlived 99.99% of humanity. What exactly are we preventing? This isn't an isolated mistake. It's emblematic of a medical system that routinely excludes older adults from clinical trials, then prescribes them the very drugs proven only to harm them. When adverse effects emerge, we blame age rather than acknowledging our own failures. This is where we are, a culture so terrified of aging that we've built an entire healthcare apparatus designed to fight it, even when that fight causes more suffering than the condition itself. Aging doesn't announce itself with fanfare. It arrives quietly, in moments we barely notice. Bruce Springsteen, at 66, joked about writing his memoir, Before I Forgot Everything. This while touring globally, performing three-hour concerts, and revealing unexpected literary talent. We fixate on what's diminishing while ignoring what's expanding. The transition into elderhood resembles childhood's opposite. Instead of clear milestones marking progress, we experience blurred boundaries and gradual evolution. A 10-year-old is unambiguously a child, but an 18-year-old straddles categories. After our 20s, development seems to slow but never stops. By our 40s and 50s, accumulated changes become undeniable, not just physically, but psychologically. Studies worldwide confirm what older adults already know. Aging brings greater self-comfort, deeper confidence, and increased life satisfaction. Yet we've constructed a society that treats this natural progression as something to hide, deny, or desperately reverse. Ask medical students to free associate with old, and they respond wrinkled, bent over, slow, weak, fragile. Ask them about elder, and suddenly the words shift: wise, respect, leader, experience. This linguistic split reveals everything about how we've othered our future selves. We don't just fear aging, we've made it linguistically impossible to age with dignity. In Puritan America, elders represented humanity's pinnacle. Today's culture celebrates youth's temporary strength while relegating the elderly to what poet Donald Hall called extraterrestrial status, treated with responses ranging from callous to good-hearted, but always condescending. Medical education reinforces this by defining normal as a healthy 70-kilogram male, implicitly white, heterosexual, middle-aged. Everyone else becomes a deviation, requiring special consideration. Children, despite occupying a quarter of most lives, receive minimal attention in medical training. Women's health gained legitimacy only when female medical students approached parity. This framework doesn't expand our understanding. It reinforces the status quo by defining people by what they are not. Standing frozen in the trauma room as a new doctor, watching colleagues work frantically to save a young man with critical wounds, the violence of medicine struck hard. When finally instructed to prep the chest wall, meticulous antiseptic circles were interrupted by a surgeon who grabbed the bottle, poured it directly onto the patient, and shoved metal, plastic, and fingers into his body without explanation or comfort. This is medicine's unexamined secret. By the WHO definition, the intentional use of physical force or power likely to cause harm, our profession contains inherent violence. Search medical databases for violence, and you'll find articles about violence toward doctors, never by them. We discuss racism and societal violence, but rarely question the violence embedded in our own practice. Repeated exposure creates tachyphylaxis, diminished sensitivity to others' suffering, which some justify as necessary adaptation, but which contributes to documented empathy decline during medical training. The immersive, sleep-deprived nature of medical education resembles indoctrination, normalizing a culture where violence becomes invisible background noise, even to those with conscience who recognize unnecessary suffering. The breaking point arrived quietly. After a successful meeting during what should have been a career triumph, a routine phone call came through. Someone said something ordinary, perhaps, keep up the great work, and something inside snapped. Not dramatically, like a ceramic pot shattering, but like a car windshield after collision, hundreds of tiny, irreparable pieces. Burnout has three criteria, and all three were met. First came emotional exhaustion, being depleted at day's end, unable to recover with time off, jumping at unexpected sounds, developing disturbed eating patterns. For every hour with patients, doctors now spend 2 to 3 hours on electronic medical records designed for billing rather than care, reducing patients' illness stories to standardized checkboxes. Second came depersonalization, cynicism toward work. Healthcare organizations proclaimed patient-centered values while implementing productivity metrics that undermined doctor-patient relationships, creating Orwellian disconnect between words and actions. Third arrived reduced accomplishment, the question of whether any of this mattered at all. Seeing patients, helping with curriculum, leading innovative programs, suddenly it all seemed as useful as rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic. The anti-aging industry hides a truth. Midlife brings the lowest happiness and highest anxiety. Life satisfaction follows a U-shape, rising around 60 and climbing steadily. By late 60s, older adults surpass younger ones on every well-being measure: less stress, depression, worry, and anger, more enjoyment and satisfaction. Those 65 to 79 report the highest well-being, followed by those over 80, then 18 to 21. The unhappiest? Middle-aged people, the ones with societal power who perpetuate negative aging stereotypes. As poet Mary Ruffel observed, "You should never fear aging because you have absolutely no idea the absolute freedom in aging. It's astounding and mind-blowing. You no longer care what people think. This freedom comes from becoming invisible and authority figures drifting away." At 81, one woman refused to remove her shoes for a Homeland Security officer. "No, I don't," she smiled, "but I'm old." Learning the exemption age was 75, she stated her age matter-of-factly. The officer stared, muttered, "That's incredible," and waved her through, never checking ID, because society assumes no one would claim to be older. The tragedy of aging isn't aging itself. It's how we've made it unnecessarily and at times excruciatingly painful, humiliating, debilitating, and isolating. At 90, Diana Athel lamented dwindling energy, a universal experience shared by the pregnant, injured, or overworked. Doris Lessing noted the disconnect. Your body changes, but you don't change at all. Mae Sarton, at 82, struggled with buttoning shirts and writing poems. Yet these same women published books in their 90s, essays in their 100th year, proving 70 isn't necessarily disaster. We need approaches that recognize humanity in all phases of elderhood, not just those who remain vigorous and disease-free. Different fields define successful aging differently. Health professionals focus on disease absence, psychologists emphasize resilience, older adults prioritize independence and relationships. But much of aging results from genetics, social circumstances, and policies beyond individual control. Imagine a world where gray-haired people are valued for who they were and who they are, people completing the full arc of human life. The final third of life, freed from youth's anxieties and middle age's pressures, can become what the French called the crown of life. We don't need to defeat aging, we need to stop making it shameful.